This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Shug McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oakland.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Pena.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to another Wednesday evening Trainer Talk edition on the Horse Racing Radio Network, all presented by our friends at Phasic Tipton. The Phasic Saratoga sale coming up this coming Monday and Tuesday evenings. You should be here for that. If you're not already planning on being here, try to get here for it. It's going to be a tremendous event. And we do welcome everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93. Of course, everybody who has been with us for the past 3 hours, Chad Summers, Ellis Starr, and Sean Feld, taking you through live racing coverage from the Spa Saratoga on XM209. We do welcome you back to the show. And of course, a special welcome to everybody just joining us across the country and around the world on our website, horseracingradio.net. And speaking of the Spa, we're taking Trainer Talk back on the road again. We are live from Saratoga here this evening in a beautiful, spectacular Wednesday of racing, and really looking forward to what's coming up this weekend on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Our coverage of the Whitney Handicap will be coming up on Saturday afternoon. And before we get to that, though, all kinds of special events, including this Trainer Talk show with a couple of outstanding trainers. Joe Orsino is going to be with us in the first half of the show, and in the second half of the program, George Weaver will be with us. So a lot of things to get to, and let's not make Joe wait any longer. He is, of course, a 57-year-old native of Philadelphia, 1,659 career winners to his credit. He is closing in on $40 million in purse earnings, and among those 1,600-plus wins are a Preakness winner and two Breeders' Cup champions. And Joe, nice enough to be with us on Trainer Talk tonight. Joe, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, welcome to the program, and quite an impressive resume, my friend.
You know what, I'm going to tell you, a couple years, more than a couple years ago, Dave Grenning pulled me up and said, Joe, you're getting close to 2,000 wins. And I've seen mixed records, and to tell you the truth, I have no way of checking it. I know sometimes they run under Joe Orsino, and sometimes it's Joseph F. Orsino. For some reason, they picked that up. I don't know why. So I'll tell you the truth, I don't know how many wins we have.
Well, it's funny that you would bring that up, because Equibase, who, of course, keeps track of all the trainer statistics and jockey statistics in terms of career winners and yearly winners, they have you listed at 1659. But as I was going back through your bio and looking at a couple of articles, I saw where it was listed as more than 1,900. So I was kind of hoping maybe you could clear that up, but it sounds like you're as confused as I was.
The time Dave Grenning told me I had 1,800 and some odd winners, I started keeping records. And from that day on, I'm at 2,396. But I don't know. Your truth, now you got me confused.
Well, it has been a remarkable career. Yeah, a remarkable career. How does a kid growing up in Philadelphia become hooked on the sport of horse racing? Take us back to the beginning.
Well, the very beginning, obviously, my dad used to take me to, Old Liberty Bell, and then over to Garden State when they were racing. So, I'd go to the races with my dad as a kid, really just enjoyed being in his company and being around. So, and that's how what got me involved in horse racing, So after that, I kind of did the rest on my own, because he had no involvement with the backside or anything. He was a builder. I was working at a restaurant across from Garden State Racetrack, called Sinelli's, which isn't even there anymore, either is Garden State. And I was parking cars when I was in high school, and I got to meet a few owners and trainers and jockeys, and one trainer took a liking to me by the name of Mickey Kroc, and invited me to come out on the weekends. And I grew up playing football, basketball, and baseball, and I didn't know what a horse was. And I just enjoyed it so much that I loved it. I just would go out on the weekends and walk horses, never got paid, just did it just for the enjoyment until I got out of high school. Then, truthfully, I was going to go into business with my dad in the building business, but he passed away shortly after that, and I realized I didn't really want to be in that business without him. Not very handy, I found that out also. So I decided to go back to the racetrack, and I never left. Every day I love it.
Yeah, it's interesting, Joe. Your story, very similar to my story with getting into the business. I grew up an hour from Saratoga, right here in upstate New York, and grew up just going to the races, becoming a racing fan, was going to work with my dad with his business, and all I could tell you is don't work with family. That didn't work out too well. I ended up moving to Kentucky, and the rest is history here with the radio end of things. So a lot of parallels there with our two stories. You know, one horse that caught my attention the first time I came to Saratoga was a horse named Easy Goer, and he was the first horse that I absolutely fell in love with. Did you have that horse when you were going to the races with your dad that just captivated you?
Not so much. Back then there were no, like, Lucases and big trainers like that. There was the local guys that had 30 horses, 40 tops. And, I was in high school and Secretariat was 73. And that's what, really got me excited about racing. And
yep.
After that, I stayed with it. But Secretariat in that whole Triple Crown, I was just getting out of high school when that happened and just on my way to the racetrack. So that's what excited me.
So you mentioned you played football, baseball, all the other sports. What did your friends think when you told them you were into horse racing and you were going to go to the horse races?
I'm not sure they quite knew what to take of it, because everybody was off to college and they were all, going in, starting, to go and learn businesses and stuff. And here I am, I said, this, I really like this. I don't think any of them really understood, but, you lose track with people and, you don't hear from people. And then all of a sudden, when Red Bullet won the Preakness, everybody found me. Everybody knew where I was at. And they all realized, hey, we did pretty good for ourselves. So...
Well, you mentioned the name Mickey Kroc as a trainer who helped you along the way. He was the first one to really give you an opportunity to be around the horses in the shed row?
Yeah, Mickey was a trainer from New England. And back then, the circuit, he would leave Suffolk and Narragansett and go to Garden State in the wintertime. So I got to meet him in the winter, and he started me out. And Mickey traveled a little bit. He only had, anywhere from 12, 15, 18 horses. He never carried a lot, but Mickey kind of just threw me to the wolves and started, me from the ground up, and I learned so much. I learned what people today that are starting out don't have the opportunity and don't take the time, because I've learned everything from the ground up, from their foot up, about a horse. He had me in those stalls and I worked. And, and back then, the racetrack's a lot different now than it was then. The racetrack back then, you worked until the big horse won. Unfortunately with Mickey,
yep,
I never knew who the big horse was. So that's when you got paid, when the big horse won. So it wasn't like now where everybody gets a weekly salary. Back then, in the low 70s, yeah, you got paid, when they had the money. So, I was doing it for, fortunately I was okay. But, you had to love it back then or you weren't surely making a living.
Well, that experience of learning from the ground up and doing a true apprenticeship, that had to benefit you when you finally decided to go out on your own.
Yes, because I still say today there are horsemen and there are horse trainers, and there's a lot of horse trainers out there, but not a lot of horsemen that actually can take a problem, fix a problem, work on a problem, not break a horse down, back up when you have to, you know, go when you're supposed to. You know, I mean, these are all the things I learned and applied when I had, you know, that the good horses for Mr. Stronach, you know, and applying that to good horses, it was a lot easier than the claiming horses.
And you took out your trainer's license in, I guess, 1977, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Bridge that gap between working with Mickey and then and taking out your license and the things that happened in between and led you to that decision.
Actually, after Mickey, I worked for a couple of different trainers. I worked for a fellow by the name of Chuck Spina, who at the time, Chuck had 30, 40 horses. Chuck was the first trainer for Len Ragusan, and his partner was Esposito. And I don't know if you know the name, but Ragusan Sheets.
Sure.
Ragusan was doing the sheets back then for himself and claiming horses with Chuck. And I was working for him. So we were very busy claiming horses. And the sheets back then, when nobody knew what they were, only these guys, you know, this is how I learned about the sheets way back then. They worked outstanding for claiming horses and putting them in. And we were doing real good. But the problem was Chuck was going to go to the Meadowlands. And I was a South Jersey guy, and I wanted to hang around. So I was thinking I either wanted to, you know, stay at Garden State or go to Philadelphia Park. Back then it was Keystone or whatever, just to, you know, stay in the area. That's when I decided to go on my own. I had a fellow by the name of Ed Gibbs and Bob Helmetag, who actually trains now, and he's been a lifelong friend. They gave me my first two horses, and I went with that and built it up and kept going from there.
Well, I'll take you on a little trip down memory lane, and I'll do it with just two words. Mr. Tiffany. What comes to mind when I say that name?
Mr. Tiffany was, actually my first win. That was a lot of fun. I took him from a farm and did it the way Mickey taught me. Pony him for 3 weeks, jog him for 3 weeks, gallop him for 3 weeks, you know. And I did it by the book. And when he won, I was hooked. That was it. That was it for me.
Yeah, what do you remember about that day when you saddled him and he ended up winning?
It was just a lot of joy. And my dad had passed away. And of course, I thought, well, boy, you know, he would have really loved seeing this. And really enjoyed, you know, seeing me at the racetrack, but it just didn't happen.
How long was it after your dad passed away that Mr. Tiffany won that race?
It was probably a year, you know, within
Wow.
a year.
Yeah. Yeah, very emotional. And great to see you make the way from Mr. Tiffany now to, well, I guess more than 2,000 career wins. We'll go with that number.
I don't know. We'll have to figure that out.
It sounds pretty good. Then, of course, you go through the stretch when you first start training. You have Mr. Tiffany. Things are going well. Take us from that point through the early part of your career before Frank Stronach comes into play.
You know, I took actually back then, you know, it was a private job for me. It was a guy from South America that was actually a friend of my mom's, and his wife was a friend of my mom's, and he asked me to come to Florida and train for him. And he had a lot of horses, but you know, a lot of them would go over to South America and stuff. And I stayed in South Florida for 2 years, and made a go of that. But that eventually didn't work, and his horses, they just would bought a lot of $1,000 cheap horses and that kind of stuff. So we went from that to back to New Jersey, my hometown, and started out. I went to my uncle had a farm in Bridgeton, and he asked me to get it going. I said, well, you know, that'd be okay. I'd just gotten married. My wife was just having a baby, and I thought, well, this would be okay. So I went to the farm, hung out there until for a little while, and was racing in Atlantic City and running horses. So they were like the slow years off the farm, running at Delaware. And I started to do some good. and you know, and get some winners. I claimed the horse and end up winning five in a row, and you know, I just was going on a little tear. So with that, I kind of moved off the farm and moved back to South Jersey and was in the Garden State area again. And that's when Garden State was just rebuilding. I ended up in the 80s and early 90s. I think I was leading trainer at five different tracks, Garden State twice, Meadowlands, Atlantic City, you know, so yeah, I was leading trainer there like five different times. And, you know, they were fun years, but I had a lot of claiming horses, a lot of cheaper horses. And then in the low 90s, I hooked up with DJ Stable, and that's the Greens, who I'm still with now, actually. I mean, they have horses spread out, but I still have a half a dozen horses for them. And, you know, they wanted to go to New York in the winter and then back to Monmouth in the summer. And, you know, we went on that pattern for a while, and that was working well. Actually, I met Andy Stronach and Jack Brothers. Has been a friend of mine, and he introduced me to Andy Stronach. And Andy, they were claiming broodmares at the time, and they asked me to claim a few broodmares for them to send to the farm to breed. So I thought, yeah, sure, no problem. They were paying me, you know, minimal money to do it. I claimed one filly, and you know, she, I don't know what happened. She missed the van, or the van didn't show, or whatever. And I told Andy, I said, Andy, you know, this filly's not too bad, and I think I can work on her, and maybe you can win your money back. You'll get her for free. So he thought, well, okay, that's a good idea. So, you know, at this point, I hadn't even met Frank yet. And the next thing I know, I ran a filly, and I had to raise her, obviously a double raise, because they didn't want to lose her because they wanted to breed her. And she won, and then she won again on another raise. And, you know, and that kind of, they took notice of me then, and they took horses out of Keeneland, that were training there, and they sent them to me at Monmouth, and we had a really good summer. Excuse me. Won a few stakes. They took a horse called Basquian, who was just an old hard knocker that had, I think, won the Queen's Plate when he was three, and I got him when he was six or seven, and then I got him to win a stake in the beginning of the meet going long, and then a stake at the end of the meet going short, and you know, they kind of knew who I was, and you know, I had horses for him off and on since like 92. And next thing I know, somewhere, you know, in around 97, they asked me, they had just hired Pat Byrne to go private, and they asked me to be a private trainer to maybe have what was called the B horses. So Pat had the A and I had the B. And, you know, that eventually turned into me getting some better horses. Tap the Music was my first grade one winner. Actually, nobody wanted her, you know, and she was just a big plotter. And Danny Vella, who was with Astronics at the time, told me, Joe, take your time with this filly because I think she's okay and she's got some talent, so, which I did. And next thing I know, I won the Gazelle, grade one. That was my first grade one winner for the Astronics. So, yeah, that's pretty much then the, you know, the Stronic years, of course, you know, I guess everybody knows about. They were pretty good times.
Joe Orsino, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And Joe, when the Stronax did come along, it was kind of timely because you did have that little stretch in the early 90s when, you know, they say this game has the highest highs and lowest lows. It wasn't quite clicking as you had hoped, and then all of a sudden they come along. How timely was that to have them come in those years when things were starting to kind of go the other way?
Well, you know, at the time I had 35 horses just for the Greens themselves, and Mr. Green was really upset that I was taking a private job, but he understood that it was the best thing for me, and you know, and kind of, you know, told me go. But yeah. The timing was great, you know. I knew I was ready for a better caliber of horse, and I wasn't going to get it, you know, with where I was at. I mean, we were active buying yearlings and two-year-olds, but, you know, we weren't competitive buying over top of the big guys at the time. So I knew for my best shot to get any good horses, even though I was getting the lesser quality Stronic horses to start out, were going to be better than a lot of the horses that I could get. So the timing was great. And you know, he hired me to be a private trainer for 5 years, and I lasted the whole 5 years. You know, there was never a problem. And, you know, they kept me supplied with really nice horses. Because, you know, we did a good job on them, but, you know, they supplied me with them. And, you know, I think we won 11 grade ones in 5 years, the Preakness, 2 Breeders' Cups. It was a good 5 year run.
Yeah, it was an amazing 5 year run. Of course, Red Bullet, your Preakness Stakes winner. Interesting story with him. He's a horse that was so brilliant early in his career. You had options. You could have run in the Kentucky Derby, but it was a conscious decision to skip the Derby and point for the Preakness, and it turned out to be the right one. How hard was that for you to pass on the Derby, considering all you'd had to overcome to get to that point?
Well, you know, the thing is, it was hard because I understood where I was at with Red Bullet. And at the time, you know, Frank wanted to do the right thing. And their theory is if a horse is not finishing through the lane, then, you know, that horse, you know, needs time in between. And they're right, 100% right. But the thing is, I had taken Red Bullet from a maiden 3/4, took him to Florida, ran him 7/8, brought him back to New York, ran him in a one-turn Gotham Mile. He won all three. And his next race, his first race two turns, was going to be the Wood Memorial. And that was his first race two turns. And you know, he got a little ranked with the two turns, and he pressed the pace, which is something we didn't want to do, but he did it. And he kept running. And you know, Fusa Ichi Pegasus at the time was a very good horse, came up to him and wore him down. I knew I had a very, very good horse going into the race, and I knew I had a great horse after the race because Bobby Frankel brought Aptitude into that race. And Aptitude, it was a come-from-behind horse, was running his eyeballs out, and Red Bullet would not let him go by. And I said, he held off a horse that was fresh and coming, and I knew he would have moved way, way forward off of that. And I'll tell you the truth, I mean, I think that the Preakness effort could have been the Derby effort if we would have gone. It was Frank's idea. You know, I'm not going to declare that it was my idea. It was Frank's idea. He thought we should skip the Derby and just get him ready for the Preakness, which ended up being a very good idea. But, you know, now you're faced with, from the Wood Memorial to the Preakness, there's a lot of time in between, and you could come up a short horse, too. So I had to be very careful in getting him ready. And, of course, we had him dead ready that day. I think if we made one mistake with Red Bullet, it wasn't passing the Derby. It was passing the Belmont. The horse was really, really good 3 weeks after the Preakness. He was in great shape. He was ready to go. And at the time, we talked about it, and we just came up with a decision to skip the Belmont. Frank was trying to create stallions, and he said, you know, Joe, nobody really wants to breed to a horse that goes a mile and a half. They all want to breed to mile horses and such. So I couldn't argue that. So he thought, why not get him ready for, like, the Travers and the Haskell, you know, run week, maybe if we're going to run them 3 weeks apart, we'll do that instead. Well, that year's Belmont, I mean, not to knock the Belmont, but commendable. That was a tough Belmont to watch because I knew we could have won it and then been 3-year-old of the year. That's what we didn't think about. So we, you know, and then in the meantime, the horse gets sick and he's not himself and he got a little EPM and we, you know, gave him time off. And he did come back running as a 4-year-old, but, you know, he was a brilliant 3-year-old. And once he got sick, he had a hard time overcoming all that. He came back and won some races, and, you know, he was still such a joy to be around. But I think we could have won the Belmont that year, too, and been 3-year-old champion.
Well, it was a magical year. Of course, along comes Macho Uno and Perfect Sting. So that's a year that I'm sure you're never going to forget.
No, you know, and I not only forget it, but it's like, you know, somebody says, I like when people say to you, well, what kind of horse are you good at training? You know, well, you go with fillies, you go with 2-year-olds, you know, some guys can only train certain kind of horses. I said, well, let's see. In 1 year, I had Red Bullet. He was a 3-year-old, won a classic. Same year, I had Perfect Sting, who won the Filly and Mare turf race going a mile and 3/16. And then we had Macho Uno, who's the juvenile champion, and he won the Breeders' Cup. Oh, yeah, and we still had that year Golden Missile, who won 2 grade ones, the Stephen Foster in the Pimlico Special, as an older horse. So I think we touched base on all grounds there that year.
Yeah, you might have wanted to think about retiring after that, because I don't know if you can top that year, Joe.
No, I'm not topping that year. And I didn't win the Eclipse Award. They gave it to Bobby Frankel, which I was very, very happy for Bobby. Bobby ended up becoming a friend because he trained for the Stronics too. Of course, I'm sad to see him gone. But he ended up becoming a friend, and we always had lengthy conversations and talked. So I was glad he won it if I didn't.
Joe, hard to believe only about 3 or 4 minutes left before we have to wrap up this first half of Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. But I do want to ask you about your family. I know that your son is a jockey agent, so he's in the business as well. If I'm not mistaken, you also have a daughter. Is she involved?
I have a stepdaughter who is 36, and no, she has no involvement. They live in North Jersey in Montclair. And my son, who, he worked for me. He worked for Sam Abbey in the racing office. He worked at Gulfstream in the racing office. He worked for TVG for a couple of years, NFL Films for a year. And he really enjoys what he's doing. And I've always told him, I said, enjoy what you're doing because look at me. I'm training horses, and yes, it has its ups and downs, but to put it simple, my wife says, well, we never go on vacation. We never do this. We never do that. I said, listen, our life's a vacation. What are you talking about? it's truly the way I feel. So yes, he's a jocks agent at Philly Park, and he's doing really well. He handles Maria Remedio, and he has her fifth in the standings. And what you didn't mention is I now have a 4.5-year-old also.
Ooh, beautiful. Congratulations.
Yeah, I did it again.
Sire of sires.
And that's been the life changer for me. If anything made me realize what was important, it was that 4.5-year-old. So it makes the job even more fun and easier because I guess you can hear it in my voice, but life's fun.
Very special. Joe, before we let our guests go, we always like to ask them what other hobbies they have outside of horse racing. When you're not at the track, and I know that that's a very rare occasion, but what other things does Joe Orsino like to do?
Well, I enjoy sports, all sports. I'm still, even though I'm living in New York, I'm still a Philadelphia fan, Eagles, Phillies, Flyers, Sixers. So I follow them and I follow sports. I live in New York on the water, and it's nothing for me to go out in the backyard and fish for a little while, so just to relax. But that 4.5-year-old keeps me pretty busy also, so that's been my hobby of late.
Well, Joe, look, I can't thank you enough for being with us here tonight. It was a really fun visit. Great to hear your story. We could have easily spent another half an hour talking about some of your other memorable moments, so we'll have to have you join us again up the road here. Excuse me, on Trainer Talk presented by
Phasic Tipton. I hope I gave George Weaver a tough act to follow.
Well, George is sitting right here.
George
is
a great guy. You're getting a good guy off him after me, so you're okay.
All right, buddy, we appreciate it. Joe Orsino here on Trainer Talk. Joe, thanks so much, and we'll catch up with you here soon.
Okay, thanks for having me, guys.
All right, and as you heard Joe mention, George Weaver in the On Deck Circle. He will be with us for the second half of Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Back with that in just a couple minutes on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Phasic Tipton Saratoga Sale.
Midnight Lucky.
Freedom Child.
Plum Pretty.
Union Rags.
Honey Proposition.
Black Onyx.
Guilt Trip.
Ranked number one by percentage of grade one stakes winners, graded stakes winners, and stakes winners among North American yearling sales. It's the Saratoga Sale, August 5th and 6th, beginning at 7 p.m. For more information, visit phasictipton.com and get your next graded stakes winner at the Saratoga Sale.
Stallwatch is a leader in portable, affordable video surveillance for the equine industry. We provide a customer-focused service to help your racehorses in permanent and temporary locations stay safe, secure, and healthy. You've made the investment in your horse's training, care, and feeding. Now you can have the easy-to-install barn camera system to monitor your investment from any smartphone or computer.
2013 Kentucky Derby winning trainer Shug McGahee said, "I'm a fan of Stallwatch. We are able to monitor our barns from anywhere."
To find out more about the Stallwatch portable surveillance system, go to stallwatch.com.
EPO Equine, the all-natural, healthy, safe, and legal blood builder, would like to extend a special congratulations to Nick and Martha Gonzalez and the entire team of this year's Queen's Plate winner, Midnight Aria, as well as Tony Alagna and all the connections of the remarkable Captain Treacherous, winner of the Metro and Meadowlands Pace. To learn more about how EPO Equine can help your equine athlete reach its true potential, contact Joe Valente at 215-501-6880 or visit EPOEquine.com. I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, maker of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, how do Flair strips, when applied to a horse's nose, help protect their lungs?
Mike, studies show that 90% of the resistance to airflow in exercising horses is in the upper airway, with the majority of that being in the nose. When exercising at high intensity, many horses can bleed into their lungs. The strips have been shown to reduce that bleeding by reducing the resistance to airflow through the nasal passages. This keeps horses healthy by keeping their lungs healthier during performance and training.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com.
The Arlington Million.
Dabusi, the European Raider, to get it, beat Gioponti, and a million shocker. But it is Cape Blanco's Million. Cape Blanco has won it from Gioponti. Little Mike close to the finish. Asari's closing, but time's up. Little Mike made every yard a winning one.
The Arlington Million, August 17th on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Go to horseracingradio.net for more information. This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Basic Tipton.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, flying solo on the show tonight as my usual entry mate, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, getting ready to make the pilgrimage northward to Saratoga. He will join me here at the spa this weekend for our coverage of the Whitney Handicap. Don't miss that, coming up 5 to 6 Eastern Time on Saturday. That is going to air on Sirius Channel 92, so a bit of a programming change there. We'll move from 93 to 92 for that coverage on Saturday afternoon. Of course, our Equine Forum show. Next week, we will be live from the Phasic Tipton Sales Pavilion right across the street from the racetrack here in Saratoga Springs. You can join us Monday and Tuesday evening for coverage of the Phasic Tipton Saratoga sale. It is a premier sale, and this is the third year we brought you that coverage. I think you'll really enjoy it, and if you're not already going to be here for the sale, you might want to think about trying to get here next Monday and Tuesday, because it's going to be outstanding, that Saratoga sale. And of course, we are here with Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton, and George Weaver, our special guest for the second half of the show. He's a 42-year-old Louisville native. He has conditioned 465 career winners, nearly $19 million in purse earnings, and a former assistant to some greats, Hall of Famer Dwayne Lucas, Todd Pletcher, and John Hennig. And he is with us now, live at the spa. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Mike. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you here. And quite a resume, and you're probably still on a bit of a high because you're coming off of your very first U.S. Grade 1 victory right here in the Priorist this past weekend at Saratoga. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. It was very exciting. We, you know, we don't get to participate in those a lot, and to win it and, you know, win it with a horse that wasn't supposed to win it, we're still pretty ecstatic and on cloud nine.
Yeah, 21-1 upsetter, Lighthouse Bay, in that race. And in order to do that, you actually had to defeat one of your mentors who had a heavy favorite in there, Kauai Katie, and that's Todd Pletcher. You got it done. Did Todd say anything to you after the race?
I was sitting next to him while the race was going off, and I was getting excited, and I knew he would be excited for me. However, he was focused on Kauai Katie and the fact that she, you know, she didn't run her A race. So I think he, you know, he gave me a little high five, but he was subdued. He was, you know, thinking more about his own business. But we're both competitive with each other, and whenever we're in against each other, we both want to beat each other. But if the other one wins, I'm sure that, you know, he's happy for me and I'm happy for him.
And I say it's your first U.S. Grade 1 winner because you also won the Group 1 Golden Shaheen in Dubai in 2005 with Saratoga County. So Saratoga, whether it's the horse name or the venue, a pretty special place for you.
It is. It is. We've made this place a home for a long time. And that Saratoga County, he was the first horse I ever bought at auction, and he ended up being a really, really really great horse to us. You know, he put us on the map and obviously made us a lot of money. And he was just... you know, it's so fun to be to have a good horse like that in your barn. It's just to be, you know, you feel like you won the lottery. It's it was a great thrill to have him.
Well, as I told you, this show much more about you and your life and your background and how you got involved with racing, some of the people that helped you along the way. Obviously, growing up in Louisville, it's not hard to put the pieces together as to how you may have gotten involved with racing. But I do have to ask you, cats or cards?
Cards.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
You know, we have a lot of listeners in Lexington who aren't going to be happy with that answer.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, I pull for Kentucky when we're not playing together, but when they play each other, it's all cards.
Yeah, I can't say I blame you, being a native of Louisville. So talk about horse racing and getting involved with the sport. Hang out in Churchill Downs, is that how you got involved?
Both my father and both my grandfathers were they liked to go handicap and bet. They weren't serious gamblers, but they knew how to read a form, and they went to the races frequently. And I was introduced to the racetrack at a very young age, and I just always felt at home there. You know, I liked playing the horses with my dad. I liked learning how to read the form, and as I got older, I was attracted to the horse as well. You know, I just thought the whole backside idea, I just couldn't wait to get back there. So as soon as I got old enough to jump the fence and sneak around and try to be back there, I was doing it. So I just was very attracted to it from the beginning. And I was introduced from, obviously, the gambling part, the gambling side from my father. But, I never had a different idea of what to do. I always wanted to train horses.
Did your dad teach you how to read the form and everything? Was it?
Oh, yeah.
He was responsible
for
that?
Yeah, he taught me how to read the form. And,
is he a good handicapper?
He is very good, yeah.
Yeah.
He's an excellent handicapper. He's always trying to come up with formulas. You know, it's, I always tell him, I was like, don't do that. You just got to handicap each race on its own. But he likes to try to come up with formulas that are winning patterns and stuff like that. So he really delves into it. It's pretty interesting stuff.
Is he always calling you to see if you like your horse in a certain race?
He does, but he bets about everything. I've cold watered him too many times. He won't pass it up. He's like, I know you. I'm going to bet on it whether you tell me to or not.
What kind of horse player is he? Exactas, trifectas, pick threes, pick fours, a little bit of everything?
A little bit of everything. Yeah. He's not. He probably doesn't play the pick sixes and stuff very much, but he'll try exactas and trifectas and, you know, looking for win place bets and stuff like that.
He must have been thrilled when you won the grade one up here the other day. Was he one of the first people to get a hold of you?
Yeah, they are. My parents texted me right away, congratulations, and, you know, we talked to him later on the phone. But they're ecstatic. They're always pulling for me, and I get a text every time we win a race. So,
what was the reaction when you finally told them, hey, look, I want to do this for a living. I want to be a horse trainer.
They were fine with it, really. I went to a couple years of college, and I just wasn't into it. You know, I was like, I really want to, you know, I didn't grow up around horses, and I really wanted to learn about it. And so I decided that I needed to educate myself more about horses and take a break from college. And they never, ever... You know, they never had a problem with it. They never put any pressure on me to stay in school or anything. They wanted me to do what I wanted to do. So they've always been supporters and backed me.
Were you going to school for an equine field, or was it for something completely unrelated to horse racing?
I didn't even declare a major. I just went because I thought I was supposed to go. You know,
was that U of L?
I started out at Center College, and then I went the next year I went to U of L. I did okay at Center, but the financial part of it wasn't coming through. So I was like, well, let me go to a little bit of a less expensive school. And I just like I said, I didn't have a major and didn't really, I just didn't feel like it was taking me where I wanted to go.
So what was your very first job on the track?
I worked as a hot walker, or signed up as a hot walker for John Hennig. And you know, you at Churchill Downs, you wait out at the gate and somebody will pick you up. And his assistant, Robbie Rader, needed somebody and he picked me up. So I started walking hots freelancing. And I don't think JK was there at the time. I met him maybe about a week later. But I told him when I went there, I was like, I'm not just here to hot walk. I want to learn. And he said, he offered, you want to come up to Philadelphia Park with us? That's where we go for the summer when this thing wraps up. And I said, yeah, I do want to go. I worked for him for the next couple of summers. And then when I quit the school, I went ahead and stayed with him. I plan on staying with him indefinitely. And he told me that, you know, if you stay in here, you know, Mark is already in Wayne Lucas's organization and Kieran. And so, you know, I can't tell you if it's going to happen in a year or 10 years, but when a door opens there, you know, you spend enough time with me and learn the ropes, I'll be able to feed you there and it will be a pathway for you.
Oh, wow.
I stayed with him you know, it ended up being about a year, and he actually went to work for Wayne out at his training center, and I got to go to New York and be a foreman underneath Jeff Lucas and Todd. So, you know, JK definitely delivered on his promise. He told me that he was going to teach me and feed me in the right direction when it was time, and it all worked out exactly like he told me it would.
Yeah, and I can imagine there's bits and pieces you've taken from everybody you've worked with along the way. We hear that from a lot of trainers here on Trainer Talk, and they kind of incorporate those things into what they do today as a trainer.
Yeah, the whole thing about training horses is it's a learning process. You learn something every day. Obviously, the time that I spent with John, I picked up a few things, and in Wayne's barn and being around Todd, and then you learn even more when you're out on your own. You start really seeing what works and doesn't work. So it's, you learn every day, and I definitely picked up stuff from them, and you pick up stuff, you know, watching other trainers too. You kind of, you might catch them doing something and you say, hey, I want to try that. And it's just learning by example and learning by experience.
I know Dwayne Lucas has a reputation, obviously a former basketball coach, has a reputation of really creating a team atmosphere and being very disciplined and very regimented. If you walk by his shed row, as you well know, everything is meticulous up and down the shed row. Talk about working with in that particular barn, working with Todd Pletcher, some of those things that you took away from those years.
When I first went into Wayne's barn, I went to their barn at Belmont, and Jeff Lucas was the trainer, and Todd was a foreman, and they were, Jeff was looking to get Todd more at the track, be able to participate more and actually watching horses train and move them up a little bit. And they needed another management person there to run the barn. And I was inexperienced, but I went there. But, I mean, right away I was impressed. First of all, the great horses they had there, but everything really worked like clockwork. I mean, it was unbelievable. And Jeff was a very challenging guy to work for, but he was
how come?
He was very he'd never let a detail go by. You know, he was on you right away, and not in a mean way, but you know, he got to the point where he noticed every single detail, and you started wanting to notice every detail, because if you didn't, he was going to chew your butt. So. He was very challenging, and it was after a while it was rewarding to work for him, because you felt like if you got through the day without him pointing out one of your mistakes, then you were doing all right.
you did something right.
Yeah, exactly.
who were some of those horses? You mentioned all the big name horses, and there was a host of big name horses in the Lucas barn at that time. But who were some of the horses that you had a chance to personally work with and be around that are going to stick out to you?
There was a lot of good ones, and I hope I don't do any shame to some of them because I'm not mentioning them. But I know I remember early on at Farm Away was there, Criminal Type, A Wild Ride was a nice mare. I mean, there's countless ones. And then later on, I remember the one year we had Serena Song, Honor and Glory, Editor's Note, Thunder Gulch, all right in the, I mean, within the same, I can't even imagine how much money's worth of bloodstock was there at that time. But some really, really top horses were there.
Yeah, and you mentioned Todd being a foreman there. And then Todd, of course, goes out on his own. When did you make the decision to branch out on your own and do it by yourself?
Well, Todd went on his own, and I had I had been working mostly with him within Wayne's organization, and Todd went on his own, and I wanted to kind of follow in his footsteps in Wayne's barn. And I did well there. I was doing fine, and we had a good summer meet and everything, but – you know, it just wasn't, at the time, it wasn't panning out. You know what I mean? The dynamics of it weren't taking me where I wanted to go. And I just, you know, I talked to Todd and said, I know at some point that you're going to need somebody. Just be sure you let me know first. Because I just felt like we had a relationship and that was going to be a better direction for me. I didn't know for sure that Todd was going to turn out to go as far as he has. But it ended up being the right decision on my part. And it, you know, going to work for Todd and then being able to go on my own, it did a lot for my business.
How good is Todd Pletcher?
He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's he works extremely hard. He gets up early. He's a hard guy to keep up with, honestly. He's very competitive, and you know, he's on it. He knows what he's doing.
I can remember being at Palm Meadows a couple of years ago and waiting. Todd was working. He was just finishing up. We were waiting to do an interview, and he came down the shed row, and his next set was getting ready to go out to the training track. And the exercise riders came out from the shed row across the way, and they came out in single file as if they were going to the paddock to ride a race. And he had all the horses lined up, and he walked up and down. He felt every single leg on every single horse, and then gave the riders a leg up, and out they went. And it was so regimented, I couldn't help but think he probably learned that type of thing from D. Wayne Lucas. And I'm sure there's a lot of regimen in your barn now as well.
We kind of do the same thing. We model after the same program. But Todd fit well in Wayne's program, but Todd is a very organized person anyway. And no matter where, if he had not worked for Wayne, if he had chosen a different avenue, he's a very, very meticulous, organized person. And, I can't imagine he would do business any other way.
Obviously, you always wanted to be a horse trainer. You mentioned that earlier, and you wanted to go out on your own. So when the opportunity finally came that you had that chance to break out and get your trainer's license and do this by yourself, what was that moment like?
Well, we were excited. The whole motive for that, I could still be working for Todd. I mean, it's great to be an assistant over there and be able to work with all those great horses. But at the time, I was engaged to Cindy, my wife, yep, who was also an assistant for Todd. And, we were expecting a child. And basically we kind of told him, was like, well, it's now or never. We got to go ahead and make a go of it. And he understood. We told him in February that – and I stayed with him all the way through Labor Day, and then we had our son in late September of that year. But it was tough. We were pretty worried that hoping that people would support us and everything. But it worked out well, and we got plenty of support, and we've been able to maintain a good business over several years now.
Talking with trainer George Weaver, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. And I know your wife, Cindy, is still very much involved in your operation. She has to be an integral part.
Cindy is very good around horses. She's great. She's a great gallop girl and very good at breeze and horses, and she's also very dedicated around the barn. I mean, she goes out of her way to make sure that everything goes right with our horses. And she's very into, and she runs the help. I mean, she really is invaluable to us. I mean, she's the backbone of the operation.
Yeah, I was gonna say, what's that like working with your wife?
Well, we have our moments, but actually I think we do pretty well considering. We have our moments. Training horses is, everybody's got their own opinion, and she's such a good horse person. She has her opinion sometimes, so there's going to be times when I have a different opinion than hers, and obviously that brings up, maybe a little bit of conflict, but I think we work it out pretty well, and I wouldn't change it, I can tell you that.
So I'm going to ask you a question that so many trainers on Trainer Talk often get stuck with, and it's surprising, but your first winner when you went out on your own was who?
It was a horse named First Spear.
You'd be surprised how many people can't remember that. It's shocking.
Maybe it helps me, yeah, that it's First Spear. First Spear it was. We only started out with seven or eight horses, and John Fort with Peachtree Stable was kind enough to send me this horse. He had been coming off a layoff, and I had spent the horse was in Todd's barn, and I had him at Monmouth, and he won a couple of three-year-old stakes and did well, and I think Mr. Ford probably asked Todd, I'm sure if I recall it correctly, he asked Todd for his blessing to give me that horse. And he ended up being my first winner. He won a three other than at Calder, and I think he paid like $26, $27 or something. But
wow,
it was the third horse we ran, I believe.
Talk about some of the horses that have come through your barn that you're just never going to forget.
Well, obviously you mentioned Saratoga County before, and many of the stakes horses that we've had, I'm not going to forget Lighthouse Bay. We had a nice old horse named Drum Major. Randy Hill, one of my great friends and great client, had the horse Christine's Outlaw when I first went on my own, and he was a super talented horse. So we'll always remember him, and, those would be a few of them there.
Was there a horse that you did some pretty good work with that was kind of a hard-knocking horse that people may not recognize the name right away, but you say, boy, this was a good horse?
We're really proud of that horse, Fiddler's Patriot. He was he's an extremely fast horse. We ended up not making a meet this year with him, but he came with his name before it was Fiddler's Patriot. Actually, was Fiddler's Longshot. Nobody really thought he'd make it to a races. He has some veterinary issues. So the fact that we were able to get him to the races and that he was able to play at the level he was playing at is pretty exciting. I mean, he never won a graded stake. He was second in a grade two, But believe me, especially here at Saratoga, I would line him up against anybody. I think he could beat just about anybody here.
That has to be so rewarding when you get a horse like that that everybody says there's no way this horse is even going to make it to the races, and you do some really good work with him, and you get him not only to the races, but get him to compete at a very high level. I mean, I would imagine, never having trained a horse, that's got to be very rewarding.
It is. It is. And it's interesting you asked me that question, because I'm sure there are other horses that are not coming to my mind. But, you know, there are some horses that require a little bit of extra TLC. And when they run well, you really, you know, you feel rewarded. You know, it's you have to put more effort into them. And when they win, and it's that extra effort that gets them there, you know, that's pretty rewarding. Because in all honesty, very good horses, anybody can train them. They're, you know, really good horses. It doesn't matter what you do. You can work them every 5 days. You can work them every 10 days. You can work them 2 weeks out. You can work them a week out. You know, good horses find a way to win despite everything. But it's some of those horses that require a little, you know, just a little special attention or whatever. Those are a little more rewarding.
Talking with George Weaver on Trainer Talk, presented by Fayza Tipton here on HRRN. George, talk a little bit about your philosophy as a trainer and your training style and the way you like to bring horses along.
Well, one of the big things in our barn, we try to make sure that the horses are happy with their routine and what they're doing. And some horses are more difficult to get that going than others. I mean, we really firmly believe that if your horse is happy with what they're doing, you know, young horses, we're trying to teach them how to be racehorses. This is your job. You're going to be a racehorse, and we want to teach you to do it and also like the fact that you're doing it. And it's just like, you know, just like a human employee, you know, they're going to do a better job at it if they enjoy it and want to do it. Now, not all horses are going to love to do it. You know, some of them are going to be scared about it, nervous about it, worry about it. And you try to do things for them that help them overcome that. So we try to work on their mental state quite a bit. And then you just try to keep them sound.
And, so you try to create a positive atmosphere around the barn. Is that right? Am I saying that the right way?
Yeah, and with the horses, you know, we feed them mints, we take them with a pony if they need to go with the pony. You know, we just try to make sure that whatever they're doing on a daily basis, they're happy with it. And, you know, that's probably, I think, what one of the biggest aspects of our barn. Obviously, we try to keep them sound, and we work on their physical issues. And, if they need particular medications or whatever, we try to, you know, do everything that we can to keep them at the top of the game. And obviously, winning races is the end point, but we do believe that a happy, healthy horse is going to run well, and we focus on that.
How soon can you tell when a horse comes into your barn what that particular horse is going to need? Because it sounds like you're treating each horse as an individual, which is probably the right approach, because every horse is different. But how often or how soon can you tell when they come into your barn what they're going to need and what you're going to have to do?
You get to know them pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And they change. Two-year-olds change a lot. When they first come in, they're fat and lazy and, you know, don't really know what's going on. And then they start getting fitter and they show a different side and they kind of wake up and sometimes they can, you know, they can start getting behavior issues or whatever. So you get a good feel when they first come in, but also it changes day to day. You know, stud horses, you know, you're trying to keep them on track and every once in a while they want to go left or go right and you're trying to keep them in the middle. So you need to make adjustments as you go along.
And you personally have had so much success with horses on all surfaces, dirt, turf. It really doesn't matter. You win on every surface, and you get horses to run well on every surface. Is there a difference between training a turf horse and a dirt horse, or is everything kind of the same?
I don't know. I think that a lot some people have labeled me or think that I have a knack for turf. You know, they think I'm a turf horse trainer, and yet the two best horses I had are dirt horses.
Yeah, does that bother you that you would be labeled as a turf horse trainer?
It does a little bit, just because I think we're effective with all kinds of horses. You know, in America, nobody really wants a turf horse. That's not what you look after. You know, that's not what you're looking for when you go purchase something. It's much more convenient to have something that can run on the dirt and be at its best on the dirt. Because that's the majority of racing, but the fact of the matter is there are some horses that have some turf in their pedigree, and there are some horses out there that just aren't crazy about running on the dirt. So the natural thing to do is work them on the turf or try them on the turf and see if they like it. And if they do, they do. So, you know, I want every horse I have in my barn to be a dirt horse, but if that's not their strong suit, I'm not going to just sit there and keep running them on the dirt just to keep them on the dirt. So, I mean, I don't like being labeled a turf trainer, but I do like turf racing. And the only thing I would say about turf horses, especially turf horses going long, is they need to be able to relax and get into a groove and and give you that turn of foot when they've got it. They need to be tractable. You know, it's all about the trip and turf racing. So I think it might even be more important to have their mind in the right place when they go over there. But other than that, I don't think it's that much different.
When George Weaver has an opportunity to sit back and kick back with a drink on your porch or whatever, and you're just kind of sitting there by yourself, do you ever just say, wow, man, I was just a kid that liked horse racing. How am I in this position? Does it ever kind of strike you like that, or what goes through your mind?
Yeah, I get goosebumps sometimes because we're very proud of what we've accomplished. I mean, I didn't grow up in a training family or grow up around horses, so there were many times when I was an assistant or on the road or path to where we are today, you know, I wondered, am I going to get clients? Am I going to be able to make it? You know what I mean? I didn't want to be a struggling horse trainer. And there's, you know, it's a tough game. I might end up being a struggling horse trainer in the future, but right now we're doing well. And we're very, you know, I do sometimes pinch myself. I was like, wow, I just won a grade one at Saratoga. Or, you know, when I was in Dubai and I won that race, I said, is this real? Is this happening? So it's very rewarding to set out a goal to go out and want to train horses and have a chance to have really top horses. And we've been lucky to have some real nice horses over the last few years.
Most trainers will always credit some of their best clients that helped them along the way. Who are some of the clients that you've had the privilege to work with that have really been a big help to you?
Well, I mentioned earlier that John Ford helped us get started with Peachtree. Cott Campbell with Dogwood supported us early on and gave us horses. And Mike Ryan is a Bloodstock agent. He was a big push for me early on, and I'm always grateful for that. He put me and Randy Hill together. And Randy Hill and I've been, you know, we have a great relationship, and we've had a lot of success, although not recent here at Saratoga, but I plan on getting some for him soon. So Mike Ryan was real instrumental in helping me get started, and there's been a bunch of others, and I hope I didn't leave anybody out that's going to get mad about it. But those are the first few people that helped us get going, and there was other people that were with Todd, or, you know, we got some exposure. So
sure.
Those are the big ones.
When George Weaver isn't at the racetrack, and I'm sure that those times are few and far between, but what kinds of things do you like to do when you're not around racing?
Well, we live out on the lake up here in the summer, so like yesterday, the dark day, we went on the lake and had some fun and got out on the boat. And we have a 10-year-old son named Ben, and we like to try to spend some time with him in some form or other, go to the movies or go to a park or do something like that. As far as having any real hobbies on the side, not really. Just try to enjoy some family time. And
you're sitting here with a New York Giants hat on. Big football fan?
I am a Giants fan. And I,
Bill Parcells.
Yeah.
Going to be at Saratoga, if I'm not mistaken, this week, right?
Yeah, I think his horse is running tomorrow. Yeah. Saratoga Snacks.
Have you had a chance to meet him?
I have. I've talked to him a few times. We're always ribbing each other. But
about horses? Does he like to talk horses and you like to talk football with him, or is it the other way around?
We talk both.
George Weaver joining us on Trainer Talk. George, just about 1 minute or so left here before we have to wrap up the show. Do want to say thank you very much for taking the time. It's been great to visit with you and hear your story. All of our guests who appear live on the program are going to receive gifts from a couple of our sponsors, EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So the EPO folks have dropped off some product here, so we'll give that to you, and we'll get you the Flair Strips here soon as well.
Very good. I can't wait to use them.
Yeah, and all the best here in the future. We didn't even get to talking about Lighthouse Bay in Saratoga County. We'll have to do that up the road.
Very good.
All right, George Weaver here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Don't forget that Fasig Tipton sale coming up on Monday and Tuesday evening. We are going to be there with you to bring you that live coverage. It all begins at 6:30 Eastern. The first horse going under the gavel at 7 o'clock Eastern or shortly thereafter. You can hear that coverage with myself and Jude Feld, and Chad Summers will be with us as well to bring you all of that. So if you're going to be driving anywhere around the country, you can tune in to that coverage on Sirius Channel 93. And, of course, it will be streamed live on our website, horseracingradio.net, as all of our shows are. Tomorrow afternoon, we are here from 3 to 6 Eastern time with our HRN live race coverage. And then from 6 to 7, excuse me, get all choked up talking about our schedule here. From 6 to 7 Eastern time, we'll bring you our BristNet.com call-in show, your chance to call in and talk racing, whatever's on your mind in the world of racing. You can do that tomorrow night. And of course, on Friday, 3 to 7 Eastern Time, that last hour from 6 to 7, our Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview, our Equine Forum Show Saturday morning live from the Spa. It will be a Whitney Handicap edition, and then the Whitney Handicap live with us on your official home for the Breeders' Cup World Championships. That will be 5 to 6 Eastern Time on Saturday night. You can see a complete schedule and listen online at horseracingradio.net. I want to say a special thank you to our guest tonight on Trainer Talk, Joe Orsino, in the first half of the show, and George Weaver for being here in the second half. If you did miss it, a podcast will be available later today at horseracingradio.net. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you tomorrow on HRRN.